It's happy birthday.
It's 8:30 New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike acts as host at a coast-to-coast quiz party. You provide the questions and our experts try to answer them. Remember, for every question used, Lucky Strike will give you not only $10 in war stamps, but a set of the 12-volume Britannica Junior Encyclopedia. If the question is muffed, you get the Junior Britannica, plus a $50 war bond, plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid, and all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Ladies and gentlemen, well, here we are back in New York after our little trip to Philadelphia last week for the Treasury Department. If you didn't hear it then, I may say that we reported a sale of $3,337,183. We repeat the sum again with some pride. $3,337,183. And this is not the last time that Hirohito and Hitler we'll hear from Information Please. Now tonight, coasting along in our usual manner, spontaneous and informal as ever, Information Please offers, as its board of experts, Franklin P. Adams and John Kieran, now regularly installed as columnists in the New York Sun and other papers, and as our two guests, the music critic and composer, Dean Taylor, and the favorite of stage and screen, Mr. Charles Coburn, whom you may have seen most recently in George Washington Slept Here. And by the way, we'd like to thank the radio editors of the United States and Canada for voting Information Please their favorite quiz program in the annual World Telegram poll. We also came in second in the all program stakes. We lost by a nose, in this case rather an odd one because it was Mr. Bob Hope's. We feel honored and we'll try to do as well again next year. And now for our first question from Jules Sweeney of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, now famous as the birthplace of Oscar Levant. Whose career could be summed up in these words? Let's get two out of three if we can. Stevedore to champion. Whose career could be summed up in those two words? Three words. Stevedore to champion.
Is that a prize fighter?
Keep going.
Well, Jimmy Braddock was.
That's right. Jimmy Braddock, yes. Started as a stevedore, ended up as a champion. Now, how about another quick biography? Barroom to Poet Laureate. Apparently, that is more familiar to these gentlemen. Mr. Adams.
John Masefield.
Yes. What barroom, Mr. Adams, did he start in?
Something in Yonkers.
Yes,
no,
it was.
No, that was a carpet company in Yonkers.
Mr. Taylor, you seem to be more familiar with this barroom.
He worked for the Smith Carpet Company in Yonkers, but he worked in a barroom down in Greenwich Village.
Yes, that's right.
What was the name of it, Frank?
I don't know.
Oh, come, Frank. Tell us. Well, whatever the name of it was, Mr. Masefield did start in the humble capacity of a sweeper-upper, I think.
Yes.
And eventually became poet laureate.
He never got to be a bartender.
No, never did. Never did. Now, here's another short biography. Train Butcher to Scientific Wizard. Who was that? Train Butcher, Mr. Coburn.
Edison.
Edison, yes. Thomas Alva Edison. And off the record, how about this one? If you don't get a gentleman, we'll brain you. Program Boy to Producer. Who was that? Mr. Coburn.
Charles Coburn.
Yes, Mr. Coburn. Now, you see, Mr. Coburn,
I know that. You've told me that 5,000 times.
I was going to say Clifton Fadiman.
Never sold programs. Mr. Coburn, where did you start as a program boy?
Savannah, Georgia.
In Savannah, Georgia? And was it an easy rise for you?
No.
No, hard, eh? Look where you are now. Mr. Adams.
I think some of the Schubert boys were program boys that later became producers also.
Thank you. That's a very nice bit of information. I'm glad to get it. How's this one from Grace Adams Pierce of Rochester, New York? Here's a Shakespearean question, gentlemen. What Shakespearean character addressed an audience as follows? Just tell me who said these forms of address. Get two out of three if you can. Here's the first. Most potent, grave, and reverend seniors, Mr. Coburn.
Othello.
Othello, good work. How does it go on, Mr. Coburn, do you remember?
Very grave and reverend seniors, that I have taken away this old man's daughter is most true.
That's right, yes. How about this one? Romans, countrymen, and lovers. Now, be careful about this.
You don't want to take all these because these are cinches for me.
You think so, eh? Go ahead, Mr. Corburn. Let's see.
Friends, countrymen.
I didn't say that. I said Romans, countrymen, and lovers. Ah. Take his pride down.
Now you've got different.
What did you say?
That's different.
Yes. Back you go to program boy, Corburn. Mr. Kieran.
I'll take a chance. Was that Brutus?
Yes, it was. Brutus is right. You were going to say
before
that.
Before he spoke, before Mark Antony spoke.
Yes. Right. Remember how that line goes on, Mr. Kieran? Romans, countrymen, and lovers, hear me for my cause.
And be silent that ye may hear.
That's right, yes. And now the third and last of these modes of address. Now my co-mates and brothers in exile, Mr. Coburn.
Banished Duke and As You Like It.
Yes, that's quite right. And can you go on with the lines, Mr. Coburn?
Well, I don't know that I can.
We can get a waiver from equity. Mr. Kieran?
Hath not occasion made this life more sweet than that of painted pomp and so forth?
Oh,
sweet
God,
are the uses of a
just
person.
Just showing off.
Like the toad, venomous and ugly and venomous.
That's right.
Who has yet a precious jewel in his head. I
now, you see, it's very easy. And Taylor, you couldn't have done as well.
Certainly not.
How about this one? From Henry B. Riley of Livingston, Montana. From these songs, which the pianist will play for us, tell what is being requested. In other words, you should know what the song is, and there's a phrase in the song, requesting something, asking for something. What's being asked for? Let's have the first. Mr. Taylor.
Give me one dozen roses.
Is it? I don't think so.
One dozen roses.
No, play that again. I will say this for the author of One Dozen Roses, that he certainly had heard this played at one time.
It's also One Dozen Roses.
Isn't it a little different, though? Just enough to make royalties possible?
Well, he can just...
Just slip by. Yes, this is Give Me That Old-Time Religion.
I like One Dozen Roses.
It may be. It's a later version.
Yeah.
Old-Time Religion is the right answer.
I was too young at the time.
Now, the second one. Do you know, Deans, what's being played?
Yes.
You do?
If
who
I
wrote it?
Think of it.
Ah, yes, that's the only trouble. Who did write it? How about a guess?
I'm going out and shoot myself when I hear who did write it.
Now, Adams, you're very good at this sort of thing. How about
it? No, I never heard that tune.
Never did? Well, it's from Don Giovanni. Does that come back to you now, Mr.
Bang.
Yes.
That's
all. And Lachi Darem Lamano.
Lachi Darem, yes, go on.
What is, who's requesting what?
I don't care, but it's Mozart, and
it's Mozart.
I'm not shot myself.
Give me your hand. May we consider you shot?
Yes.
Okay.
Three quarters.
That's one out of four, anyway. Now the third and last. This is really in Levant's generation. I don't know whether you folks know it at all.
I bowed out with Mozart.
Mr. Adams?
Never heard of it.
Well, it's Beat Me Daddy 8 to the Bar, so a beating is being requested. Made a beautiful record on that, gentlemen. 3 wrong out of 3. You should send more than a $50 war bond to Mr. Riley and a set of the Britannica. How about this one from Walter C. Jones of Blissfield, Michigan? Who carried the message sent by the following people? Who carried the message? The Burgesses of Ghent. Sent a message. Mr. Kieran.
I am Dirk and Jarvis.
Good. What are you talking about?
Browning's poem.
I sprang the
thing
to the stirrup.
Ah, you see, once Mr. Kieran starts, you all know it.
I galloped, Dirk galloped, we galloped all three.
That's right.
What they brought was good news.
What brought the good news from Ghent to Aix by Browning. And now, Colonel Arthur Wagner sent a message. Who carried it? I get a blank look. No, I don't. I get 4 blank looks. Mr. Adams.
Man named Rowan.
Good work. Who was he?
He took the message to Garcia.
That's right. Mr. Kieran?
Well, history has it that McKinley sent the message.
Well, wasn't he actually dispatched by his superior officer, Colonel Wagner?
He was.
Yes, and I think I read in the papers just the other day that then-Lieutenant Rowan died just last week as a colonel. Yep,
that's right. He died a week ago in San Francisco in the Army hospital there. But he didn't actually... He carried a verbal message. He had nothing written.
No, nothing
written. And it was McKinley's message.
But McKinley had a ghostwriter.
All right, I won't quibble.
Blondie Ryan. Who carried the message sent by Blondie Ryan? Mr. Kieran.
Western Union.
Western Union, right. Look, for my benefit, Mr. Kearney, will you explain your answer?
The Giants were on a westward swing with a pennant at stake, and they were bogging down along the road. Blondie Ryan was a young shortstop, and he had been injured, and he was left back home, and he sent a short message to this effect. They can't beat us. I'm on my way.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
You remember a good deal from your experience as a sports writer, don't you, Mr. Kearney?
Oh, a little.
No. How about this?
I think that was sent by a postal.
well, it might have been at that.
I never forget it.
We got 2 out of 3 on that. Now, how about this one from Mrs. Cecilia Tontrup of Miami, Florida? Gentlemen, you're to sing a song popular long ago that includes the lines, "When you're away." Now, our pianist is here to help you if necessary. You've just been resuscitated, Taylor. You better come in on this. When you're away. Now, you have to sing a song that includes those lines. Mr. Kieran?
I think that's included in Some of These Days.
How does it
when
go?
When you're away.
Mr. Coburn?
Right near the end.
Who's kissing her now?
Don't ask me. This is this is not a kiss program. Mr. Adams.
It sounds like Irving Berlin.
No, it's Victor Herbert is what I'm thinking of.
When you're away.
How weary.
That's approximately. Right?
Yeah, well, that's it more
sounds like a war bond to me.
Yeah, I think it's going to be. When you're away, dear, how weary the lonesome
hours. I just
hours.
Said that.
Yes, but you sang it. I couldn't understand you.
But you asked me to sing it.
Was that his singing?
Certainly I could sing.
You're trying to bluff us into keeping this $50 war bond.
No.
Now, how about a phrase, how about a song that includes the phrase, "When hearts are young"? When hearts are young. Mr. Adams.
That might be Hubby.
A song or just a poem?
And a good song ringing clear.
Nah.
Nah?
1,000 times.
Well, Taylor knows what's wrong. He doesn't know what's right, but he knows what's wrong.
That isn't a Bohemian Girl, is it?
It's from Lady in Ermine by Romberg and Goodman.
I knew it all the time.
When love's a star, a song unsung, a magic land that gleams afar. Does that come back to any of you?
Never heard it.
Oh, too wrong, honestly. Very good. And how about a song that includes the phrase, "When New York"?
When what?
When New York, and it goes on. When New York
was a little town.
Sing it.
I don't know. I never heard of it. I just guessed that.
When New York was New York, the town we used to know, when New York was New York, not so many years ago, who wrote it? Mr. Coburn, is that the back here?
Never heard of it.
Terrible lyric. George M. Cohen wrote it.
I can't help it. It's still a terrible.
3 wrong out of 3 and a $50 war bond to Miss Tontrup and a set of the Britannica.
We miss them, they stay missed.
And now Mr. Cross has a little quiz addressed especially to smokers.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask you 2 very easy-seeming questions about the cigarette you smoke. First, what's the important ingredient in your cigarette? Well, an instant's reflection should tell you it's the tobacco that counts. Now, my second question. Were independent tobacco experts present at the auctions down south where tobacco for your cigarette was bought? Ladies and gentlemen, the answer is emphatically yes. Independent experts, auctioneers, buyers, and warehouse men earn their living at these auctions by buying, selling, and handling the leaf. And obviously, in their daily work, they see just who buys what tobacco. So, smokers, you can see how important is the overwhelming preference of these independent experts for Lucky Strike. Indeed, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. Mr. Fadiman, isn't the conclusion to my little quiz perfectly clear? That Lucky Strike means fine tobacco, so round, so firm, so fully packed, so free and easy on the draw.
Yes, Mr. Cross, in 59 seconds, you've given smokers something worth remembering and worth acting on. And now a question from Louise Craig of Blairsville, Pennsylvania. Well, this is going to be all about a very tempting idea, the idea of butter. What is the source of each of these quotations about butter? The first is, a little bit of butter. Mr. Kieran.
A little bit of... All the king wanted was a little bit of butter with his bread.
Right.
A royal slice of bread.
Yes, who wrote the poem?
Milne.
Yes, A.A. Milne. Very good. The King's Breakfast. And now, the best butter. What's the source of the quotation, the best butter? Mr. Taylor?
Alice in Wonderland.
That's right. Alice in Wonderland. Remember the situation in which the phrase is used?
The Mad Hatter.
That's right. Reproaches.
The Mad Hatter and the Dormouse.
March Hare, I guess.
The March Hare.
Mm-hmm.
And they put butter in the works of the watch.
That's right. And what's his excuse?
Well, it was the best butter.
The best butter, yes. How about this one? A great big pool of melted butter. Mr. Adams.
That was Little Black Sambo.
Yes.
Around the tree.
That's right. So what was the pool of melted butter the remains of?
Tigers.
Tigers, yes. All that was left of the tigers. And what does Black Mumbo use the butter for? Later on, remember?
To put on 57 pancakes.
Say, you read that book through, didn't you?
Oh, many times.
Very good. That's three
How
butters out of three.
How many have you, Mr. Adams?
Four.
He knows some grown-up literature, too, Deems. Now, how about this one from H.N. Summers of Evanston, Illinois? What famous personality described himself in the following phrases? First, as the world's worst juggler. The world's worst juggler, Mr. Coburn.
Mr. Adams?
W.C.
Fields.
I don't think so. As a matter of fact,
he was a good juggler.
He was a very good juggler, and
he
still is.
He described himself as the worst.
I'm not sure about that. Mr. Kieran, what were you going to say? Mr. Taylor, Mr. Adams?
I don't know. It wouldn't be Joe Cook.
No, Fred Allen.
He was a good one.
Fred Allen is fond of describing himself as the world's worst juggler, and so far there's been no reputation.
Sure, he didn't take it from Fields.
Well, now he might have at that. He doesn't usually borrow, unlike some other comedians that we know. What famous personality described himself as the best bad actor in the world? The best bad actor in the world.
Oh.
Mr. Taylor.
Corse Payton.
Yes, Corse Payton. Famous ham.
Used to run a stock company in Brooklyn.
That's right.
He was, too.
What? Did you ever see him?
Yeah.
And was he really very bad?
Oh, wonderful.
Wonderfully bad.
Terrific.
And the third and last, I'm a bad boy. Who describes himself that way? Mr. Kieran.
Costello.
Oh, you do listen to your colleagues.
Oh, he's very good, too.
Very good. And his partner is?
Abbott.
Abbott and Costello. Yes, Costello was the bad boy on that program. And how about this one from Helen Schuyler of Sherman Oaks, California? Now, this is a complicated musical question, gentlemen. We're going to hear the solo part of a duet. Is that clear? Wait until the solo makes sense to you, until you can identify the selection. Then we'll stop the soloist. And then you will have to sing the duet along with the soloist. Sing the duet that follows. Let's have the first.
It's been nice seeing you all.
When I go out the door of damosels a score, all sighing and burning and clinging and yearning will follow me as before. I shall with
Mr. Coburn, how about you? I think you can do better than that historic chant of Mr. Adams's.
I don't sing those words.
Pardon?
Bunthorn and Patience.
Impatience. Now, how about getting the words, getting together and giving us the duet? That's quite right, Mr. Coburn. How does it go?
Oh, something Howell and James, young man.
Let's start from the beginning. I'll give you the first two words. A most? All right, let's have the solo start us off.
A most intense young man, a soulful eyed young man.
Where's the duet?
An ultra poetical, super aesthetical, out of the way young man. Conceive me if you can, an everyday young man. A commonplace type with a stick and a pipe and a half bed, black and tan.
Well, the soloist is doing very well. That much I will say.
That's just the same thing.
Yes, but you didn't give us the duet, Mr. Adams. I want to hear that voice of yours.
It's an old song. It doesn't matter about the words as long as you got the tune.
I think I have to call that, certainly only half credit. Now let's have the second solo, and you gentlemen come in on the duet.
There was a time forever gone. Oh,
that.
I can't sing that. I think that's from the Princess Ida.
No.
Maybe not.
No. Mr. Coburn, does it come back to you?
I don't know.
It's from the Gondoliers. And the duet, let's have that duet. Let's see how it goes.
Oh, bury, bury, let the grave close o'er the days that were, that never will be more.
Thank you. By the way, to prevent any misconception, those were two professional singers, not Adams. And now the third and last.
None shall part us from each other. One in life and death are we.
Out to thee and thou to me.
Wonderful.
That's Maya Lansing.
That's right.
Maya Lansing.
I must say that Mr. Adams is a little out of voice this evening. He has a bad cold.
You'd never know it.
Well, we lose a $50 war bond on that and a set of the Vacant. We're going to Helen Schuyler of Sherman Oaks, California, and sending us on to another question.
You mean just
Mrs.
because Adams can't sing?
He did better than you did, Taylor.
Well, I'd sense enough to keep quiet.
This one comes from Mrs. E.T. Rumble, Jr. of Cochecton, New York. Who are these doctors of the stage or screen? Famous doctors. The first was Dr. Lazare. L-A-Z-E-A-R, who died a heroic death. Who was he? Dr. Lazare. Mr. Adams.
I think that was in the thing about the Yellow Jack.
That's quite right. That's quite right, Mr. Adams. Is one of the doctors in Yellow Jack a play by whom, Mr. Adams?
Sidney Howard.
Sidney Howard. And Paul de Kreif, the eminent writer on bacteriology and other subjects. And Dr. Lazare died, I guess, down in Panama, wasn't it? Attempting to discover the cause of
Cuba.
Yellow fever.
In Cuba.
In Cuba, was it? Thank you, Mr. Coburn. And how about this doctor? Dr. Tower, who died by his own hand. Suicide. Dr. Tower. T-O-W-E-R. Does that come to any of you, Mr. Coburn? Does that ring a bell
in
your mind?
Is that in fiction or in...
That is in fiction, yes, and also in the movies. Well, it is the doctor in King's Row, a novel and also a movie. Now, Mr. Coburn, didn't you play a part in that?
I played Dr. Gordon in it.
And how do you explain your lapse of memory?
I don't remember anybody's name.
You just do your own part and that's all there is to it?
I mean, I can't remember your name. I don't know Frank Adams' name.
Hey, you ought to be a quiz master.
He wasn't on the set that day.
Yes, it was a doctor in King's Row. And now, finally, Dr. Blenkinsop, who was cured. He was ill, and he was cured. Dr. Blenkinsop. Who was Dr. Blenkinsop? Dr. Blenkinsop, Mr. Taylor? I bet you're right.
Doctor's Dilemma.
Sure, that's right.
Yeah, by George Bernard Shaw. That's
quite right.
Uh-huh.
And who was he?
Well, they decided to cure him instead of Alfred Lunt.
Yes, Dr. Ridgeon is compelled to choose between Dubedat, the artist, and his classmate, Dr. Blenkinsop, and he saves Blenkinsop. Well, we did get 2 out of 3 on that. And now, before we go on to the next question, Mr. Rysdale tells us of a gentleman from Missouri who wanted to be shown that luckies are so round, so firm, so fully packed, so free and easy on the draw.
Well, after a recent broadcast, I was introduced to a member of the audience who said with a smile, Mr. Rysdale, where did you get that line about luckies being so round, so firm, etc.? That's no mere phrase, I replied, but a fact. A very important fact about luckies. He smiled and declared, well, you got to show me. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I literally did show him. First, I took a lucky strike from my package and asked him to roll it between his fingers to see for himself how round and firm and fully packed it was. Then I took another lucky, just as I'm doing right now, and put it between my lips. I struck a match, like this. I held the match to the end of the cigarette and blew out through the cigarette this way. And what happened? Well, as the gentleman from Missouri saw, the match goes out, proving beyond the shadow of a doubt that luckies are truly free and easy on the draw. Ladies and gentlemen, why not try this little test sometime? Yes, make your next purchase Lucky's and prove to yourselves that Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. So round, so firm, so fully packed, so free and easy on the draw.
Thank you, Mr. Rysdale. And now a question from Showell Busby of Merchantville, New Jersey. What's the first line of the first stanza of the poem whose second stanza begins this way? The second stanza begins, I sent thee late a rosy wreath. How does the first line of the first stanza begin? Well, I have several hands. Mr. Kieran.
That's Ben Johnson's to Celia.
And it begins?
Drink to me only with honor.
That's right. And that's one I bet that Mr. Taylor could sing. How about this one?
Drink to me.
Now, oh, I never thought you'd do it, Mr. Taylor. Now, the second stanza begins, now fades the glimmering landscape on the sight. How does the first one begin? Mr. Kieran?
That's elegy written in a country churchyard.
That's Massenet's elegy you're thinking of, yeah. Mr. Taylor.
Curfew tolls the knell of parting days.
Yes. Gray's elegy written in a country churchyard. And now here's the tough one. The second stanza begins, as fair art thou, my bonny lass. And how does the first stanza begin? Mr. Adams? Mr. Kieran?
John Anderson, my Joe, John?
No, but it's
my love is like a red rose.
It's a burn.
Very good, Mr. Adams. That's right. Oh, my love's like a red rose.
Sprung in June.
That's quite right. And that gives us 3 out of 3, gentlemen. And that's all we'll have time for. Thank you, Mr. Coburn and Mr. Taylor, for contributing your talents this evening. Now, in a few seconds, I'll announce next week's guests. Tonight, Lucky Strike has paid out 3 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica and 3 $50 war bonds. And speaking of bonds, ladies and gentlemen, the recent release by our State Department of the white paper covering our diplomatic policy from 1931 to 1941 has made one thing crystal clear. This war did not begin, as some of us like to think, on December 7th, 1941. It began at least as far back as Hitler's ascension to power. Some think it began at Versailles. In any case, it began with the Germans. Between these enemies of the human race and ourselves, there can be no compromise. To destroy them and to prevent them from plotting World War Number 3, buy war bonds and stamps as if your life depended on it, for it does. Now, next week, the trio of regulars, Mr. Adams, Mr. Kieran, and Mr. Levant, will be on deck. And as our guest, we're very happy to announce the masterful director of motion picture thrillers, whose latest work, which you can now see on Broadway, is Shadow of a Doubt, Mr. Alfred Hitchcock.